from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Today, the drug that can stop a fatal opioid overdose.
No one's ever happy to be naloxone, but as you can imagine, they've almost died. Most people at that point have sort of a moment of clarity.
That's Louise Vincent. She's worked with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, a nonprofit group dedicated to reducing heroin overdoses. Vincent has battled addiction with a lot of drugs, including heroin herself. She's never been given naloxone, but has administered it to more than 100 people, and she wants it to be more accessible to fight the opioid epidemic. But first, call them snowflakes who need to buck up, or call them vulnerable young people who need help and support. Either way, mental illnesses such as anxiety and depression are common on college campuses. We talked about this on the show with researcher Peter Gray of Boston College.
There's a lot of evidence that they are not as tough. They're not as gritty. They break down emotionally more easily about things that used to be called bumps in the road, that used to be the kinds of things that a person would take as part of the stride of life.
Now, here are your first thoughts. Miranda Kyle, 13, goes back to the helicopter parenting hypothesis. She tweets, I see students being chauffeured to and from the Savannah College of Art and Design by their parents daily. Looks like grade school for grown-ups. Ouch. And Roy Lee 1 adds this on Twitter. The biggest problem with parents nowadays is they keep their kids from danger rather than teaching them to face it. Listeners, we always want to know what you think. Tweet us at OST Talk. We're also on Facebook.com/On Second Thought Radio, or call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457, and we might feature your comments on the show. New research on anxiety in the workplace finds that in some cases, anxiety can actually help improve employee performance. This study, published in the Journal of Applied Psychology, finds that too much anxiety can, of course, derail job performance, but moderate anxiety can drive performance. We focus now on one type of anxiety. More than 15 million people in the United States deal with social anxiety disorder. That's an extreme fear of social situations. A dinner party, a trip to the grocery store, or even a meeting at work can turn into a paralyzing experience.
As I'm driving to work, I can feel the anxiety building. My stomach starts to get sick, and I start to sweat. By the time I get into work, driving up that driveway, I'm pretty much a mess.
Georgia State University psychology professor Paige Anderson developed a technology to help people with social anxiety. She uses virtual reality software to simulate real-life settings that cause patients anxiety. The tech helps them learn to cope before they have to confront the same scenarios in the real world. I talked with Paige Anderson about her work. She made it clear that virtual reality will not cure social anxiety.
Well, it's not necessarily virtual reality that cures social anxiety or probably anything. It's what the technology can do for you. The successful treatment for social anxiety and most anxiety disorders is the major success story for psychological science. It's based on a very simple principle that in order to overcome your fears, you have to face your fears. Now, that is much easier said than done.
I bet.
And most people don't seek treatment and sometimes can't tolerate that kind of treatment for their anxiety. So the idea of virtual reality is if you can take the first step in a virtual world, then you'll be able to do so in the real world.
But I suppose the reason a social situation would give anyone anxiety is that the other humans involved are real. What makes a virtual reality dinner party, for example, more real of an experience than just watching a movie about a dinner party?
It doesn't make it any more real of an experience, but it allows you to practice ways of thinking that will decrease your level of avoidance for the real situation or the real dinner party.
I want to play a clip from psychologist Jack Gorman of Columbia University. This is from the documentary Afraid of People. Let's take a listen to his description of social anxiety disorder.
People with social anxiety disorder become very overly sensitive about what other people are thinking about them. Interestingly, they'll often come in the office and say, I'm paranoid, but they're not paranoid at all. What it is they have tremendous interpersonal sensitivity. So every time they're around other people, they think that people are judging them because they think they're actually doing bad.
Paige, you touched on this earlier, but what is the conventional treatment for social anxiety disorder?
The conventional treatment for social anxiety disorder is cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a therapy of thinking, that's the cognitive part, and behavior, that's the doing part. most people with anxiety avoid the thing that they're afraid of, and that's the key aspect for recovering from anxiety, is to create new experiences so that you can create the life you want versus avoiding experiences that make your life smaller.
Let's hear one more clip here from psychologist Jack Gorman of Columbia. Here he's going to mention a few scenarios that are often difficult for socially anxious people.
They'd be afraid to use public restrooms. They become afraid to eat in restaurants because they're afraid people may be watching them and they may spill their food or choke. We've seen people who are afraid to endorse a check in front of a teller because while the teller is watching, their hand starts to shake.
We're talking about a new treatment for social anxiety disorder involving virtual reality. Paige, could you maybe walk us through one of the treatments that you might do with someone using virtual reality technology?
Sure. Well, in order to do a successful exposure therapy or the behavioral therapy, you need to have the person face their fear in a way that is controlled, repeated, and prolonged. So you can't just face your fear and recover.
I think we should emphasize that, because that's something that we see in popular culture a lot. People having a sudden immersion, Indiana Jones falls into the pit of snakes and spends an hour with horrifying snakes and comes out of it completely cured of his snake fear. It doesn't work like that, right?
That's right. You have to face your fear in a therapeutic way. You need to take baby steps so that you get a sense of mastery control before you face a more fearful situation. You need to do it over and over again. So if you get up to give that class presentation, rush really fast, grit your teeth and bear it and sit down, oh, it's over. That's not really successful exposure therapy. And then here's another key. You need to stay in the situation long enough for your anxiety to diminish so that you come away from the situation saying, I can handle that, versus, whew, I just barely got through it and I don't think I'll get through it the next time.
Sure. But put the helmet on me, right? I mean, I'm honestly, Paige, I'm someone who's suffered from some degree of social anxiety through his life. Put the helmet on me and walk me through a treatment that you might do with me.
Sure. Well, the treatment that we just published in a study in 2013 had people put on a helmet, and they had three different virtual environments that they could practice facing their fears in. One was a virtual classroom where you gave a presentation. We uploaded your presentation to a virtual podium, and the classroom could have different reactions to you. Sometimes they'd nod, sometimes they'd look confused, sometimes people were checking their phone. We also had a virtual conference table so that people could practice going around the table, introducing themselves, which is a high source of anxiety for people.
Yeah.
I have to say, I appreciate that you brought up that you've suffered with some sort of social anxiety. I think people wouldn't imagine that radio personalities would do that. One of the things about social anxiety is that it is mistreated, misdiagnosed, and most people don't know that effective treatment is out there. Up to 92% of people with social anxiety never receive treatment, and when they do, it's on average 10 to 15 years after they've started struggling.
Well, for me, I mean, this is a good example of my particular social anxiety, which is that one of the reasons I do what I do, one of the reasons I found a home in journalism, was that the kind of conversation that you and I are having right now, Paige, I know what I'm supposed to do, right? I know what my role is. I know the parameters. Everything seems really, really structured and defined. Whereas if I'm just out there trying to socialize with someone in a bar or something like that, that is much more open-ended and is much more difficult for me. Therefore, this kind of talk is a lot easier for me. My guest is Georgia State professor Paige Anderson. I'm not making it sound too easy right now. She's an expert in how virtual reality technology can help patients with social anxiety. I suppose being a guest on a live radio program isn't necessarily one of the scenarios you've programmed into the VR helmet yet, but maybe could be something you do at some point.
Sure. You know, and the story that you tell about yourself really highlights something about social anxiety, which is most people minimize social anxiety because most people can relate to feeling anxious, to being worried about what other people will think of them.
Right.
So it really becomes social anxiety disorder when it becomes extreme and it starts to affect your life. And there are two ways that social anxiety can affect your life. Two of the most important ways is relationships and opportunities. So obviously, you're successful. You're here on the radio, so a little social anxiety hasn't affected the opportunities, at least career-wise, that you've afforded yourself. I can't say anything about the relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, to tell another story about that, the person who's sponsoring the research that we're doing at Georgia State is a family foundation, the Kukas Foundation, that was developed after their son, Andy Kukas, died by suicide, in part because he was misdiagnosed, with social anxiety, couldn't find the right treatment, and then had a hard time engaging with the treatment when it was available. And this was a person who was full of accomplishment and even fuller of opportunity and potential. But because of his social anxiety disorder, that wasn't realized. So this family has developed a foundation to raise awareness about social anxiety disorder so that this doesn't happen to another family. So I have a lot of admiration for that, and it really connects with my goals for my research, which is to develop treatments that are effective, practical, accessible, and acceptable to the people who need them.
Yeah, that's got to be a powerful source of motivation.
Yes.
So you were describing earlier a treatment in which you put the helmet on somebody, they see an audience to whom they're supposed to give a presentation, and the audience appears bored. They're fiddling with their phones. Very, very nerve-wracking situation. So you have your patient practice in that virtual reality environment. What's the next step? What's the next baby step toward doing that with real people?
Well, to do it in the real world. And so people with social anxiety disorders often don't set goals for social interactions for themselves in the real world. They just say something sort of vague, like, I need to get through it without being anxious. So we teach people how to set concrete, specific goals, such as going up to their TA to ask, why did I get this poor grade on a paper? And if you can do that, you've successfully met your goal. You can't have your goal be not to experience anxiety. We all experience anxiety all the time. It's not dangerous, and it shouldn't let you keep you from doing what you need to do and want to do for your life.
Paige, what do you still want to learn about social anxiety? Where does your research go next?
You know, a lot of it is about dissemination and how to get more treatment out to more people. And stigma is a major issue in getting treatment for social anxiety disorder and really all sort of mental health disorders. And that's another aspect of the technology that is appealing to me. Whereas a lot of people still have stigma about going to see a therapist, everyone is used to using technology to make their lives better.
That's Paige Anderson. She's an associate professor of psychology at Georgia State University. We spoke about her research to treat social anxiety disorder with virtual reality back in 2016. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. The opioid crisis affects our entire country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta report that prescription opioids alone killed more than 32,000 people in 2016. Things are so bad, the U.S. Surgeon General last month advised more Americans to carry the medication Naloxone, also known by the brand name Narcan. First responders use it to stop an opioid overdose in progress. Surgeon General Jerome Adams told NPR that people need to be prepared to prevent opioid deaths.
Over half of the overdoses that are occurring in homes, and so we want everyone to be armed to respond. We should think of it like an EpiPen or like doing CPR on someone.
Nationwide, communities are examining the role of syringe exchange programs in the opioid epidemic. One Georgia pastor plans to move forward with a needle exchange program at his church. But as GPB's Ellen Eldridge reports, that is not going over well in his conservative community in Cherokee County.
Earlier this year, Pastor Gary Lamb floated the idea of offering a needle exchange program at his Action Church in Canton. Clean needles for addicts who come to Sunday service. That got a reaction.
And we did that, all hell broke loose on Facebook and kind of went viral in our community to the point that the sheriff's department had to get involved, the marshal's office got involved, the local authorities got involved, the health department got involved.
The Canton Police Department told him the needle exchange idea was flat out illegal. But according to health experts, it might not be a bad idea. Sean Allen is with the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. He spoke at the recent National Prescription Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit in Atlanta. Allen says when you think about treating diseases like HIV and hepatitis C, needle exchange programs save money.
A 2014 study found that a $10 to $50 million funding increase for programs throughout the country would ultimately result in a net savings of between $65 and $269 million in averted HIV treatment costs.
Needle exchanges can stop needle litter, too, which poses its own health issues, like accidental infection. J.J. Widener lives in Canton. He found a syringe on the ground outside a local elementary school.
It's not uncommon in Cherokee County to find syringes beside the road where people who are worried about getting pulled over with a syringe throw them out. You know, a lot of people throw them into trash cans, so you run the risk of sanitation department workers being stuck. 20-ounce soft drink bottles become sort of impromptu sharps containers.
Widener is a mental health counselor specializing in addiction. When he heard Pastor Lamb's idea, he offered to help the church with outreach.
It's an opportunity to form a connection and bring people in out of the shadows, you know, which is that's a win-win any day of the week, because if you don't have clean needles, you're not going to stop using. Nobody says, I don't have a clean needle, I guess I'll just go to rehab. That's not the way it works.
Lamb says his idea speaks to the church's mission of meeting people where they are, in the same way Jesus is said to have done. But former addict Melissa Hughes of Ackworth disagrees. 11 years sober, she thinks drug use is a choice, and infection a consequence. Reaching addicts takes prayer, not clean needles.
Minister to them. Give them food, give them clothing, give them a Bible. You know, don't give them a syringe. Don't give them dope. Don't give them, because you're enabling that person to go out and to continue use when all you do is really killing them.
Lamb wants to do all of that, but he says first he has to give addicts a reason to show up.
We kind of always say you got to catch a fish before you clean it. And so I think Jesus would have been doing that. He would have been meeting people right where they were, meeting them where they had needs, and doing whatever it took to help those people along their journey.
Lamb plans to move forward with the syringe exchange program with the help of healthcare experts.
We had several pharmacists, several local doctors, several groups out of Atlanta reach out to us and let us know anything we needed from a trained and professional medical person. They'd be willing to come to our building.
If he succeeds, it will be the third needle exchange program in the state. For GPB News, I'm Ellen Eldridge in Atlanta.
Now let's look again at this drug naloxone, a drug that when administered to a person who is experiencing an opioid overdose can actually prevent them from dying. Let's talk about how it works.
No one's ever happy to be naloxoned, but as you can imagine, they've almost died. Most people at that point have sort of a moment of clarity.
That's Louise Vincent, a naloxone consultant and health educator with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. The nonprofit group is dedicated to reducing heroin overdoses. Vincent has battled addiction with many drugs, including heroin. She's never been given naloxone, but has administered it to more than 100 people.
When naloxone is administered to a person, they go into an immediate withdrawal. People will talk about it like it's a terrible flu. To be thrown into withdrawal because of naloxone is very, very uncomfortable. It's like your body is going through withdrawal at a speedier rate, so it's sort of like withdrawal times 100.
Across the country, first responders, drug prevention centers, and addicts' families are investing in medications to stop overdoses in their tracks. But they're costing more and more, these drugs. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams was asked about rising prices during a recent NPR interview.
The president has asked for and Congress has approved $6 billion in funding to respond to the opioid epidemic, more than has ever been approved in history. There's $50 million in funding that has been allocated specifically for naloxone. Number two, we're working with insurers. 95% of people who have insurance coverage, including Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE and the VA, are actually able to get naloxone at little or no copay, and we're working with them to make that copay as small as possible. And then finally, work with Adapt Pharmaceuticals and Kaleo, the two makers of at-home naloxone, to make it easier for individuals to access naloxone at low or no cost.
A few years ago, Georgia lawmakers passed a bill allowing law enforcement officials to be trained to carry and administer naloxone. We spoke with three guests who have experience administering it in the field. Robert Childs is the executive director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. Mona Bennett is the co-founder of the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition. And Daryl Tollison is a deputy chief in the Atlanta Police Department, which trains its officers to use naloxone. That program was in its infancy and still being piloted when my colleague Celeste Headley spoke to all three of them in 2015. Here's Celeste.
Daryl, tell us first about how naloxone works in the field and what training is involved in getting an officer prepared to use it.
We thought that it could be valuable if a police officer should carry it or would carry it, because many times a police officer arrives on these medical calls before our EMTs do. And sometimes an officer, quite frankly, feels a little bit helpless. There's not a whole lot he can do. So we thought it could be valuable if we could put it in the hands of police officers. So we decided to purchase 100 dosages. We trained 100 police officers, and now we deployed it to those officers. And we've also put it in an area where the officer is most likely to encounter a person that's suffering from an overdose. So we put our officers through a two-hour training. It's a very simple process to use, so there's nothing complicated about it. Probably the most complicated thing is just putting the three pieces together, because, again, we use the nasal Narcan delivery system. So our officers were very, very responsive to the training.
Robert, how effective is this drug at preventing death?
It's extremely effective. If you administer the medication, you know, it's going to work if it's an opiate or opioid. The one thing to consider, though, is if it's a very strong opiate or opioid, such as fentanyl, you may require two doses to bring them back. And so that's why pricing is extremely concerning to us, because some departments can't afford two doses in a kit. So if it's two people who have overdosed or multiple people have overdosed, or it's a very strong opioid, you know, we're leaving our officers not fully prepared. And one thing I'm very concerned about is making sure all our officers are prepared and have all the tools they need to do their job.
Well, what we're talking about here in terms of the ways that you administer this is, Daryl was talking about the nasal use of it and the drug that's strong enough to be administered through the nose. But Mona, why, if the price is going so high, why not just use the injectable, something that you put in a needle?
We are using the injectable. In fact, we're having this great success at saving lives with the needle in the vial. Now, I have come across some people who are just not comfortable handling syringes. But even then, I have managed to patiently train and practice with people where they are more comfortable with a vial and a syringe.
And I wonder, Robert, what happens when someone's given a dose? I assume they're taken to the hospital anyway, or what happens then?
So if a law enforcement administers the medication, oftentimes EMS is pretty, you know, is right behind
on
them.
The way,
so
yeah.
It's either with some, where I get concerned more is in rural settings where EMS may be like 15, 20 minutes behind. You know, officers need to be given all the tools necessary to respond to the emergency. But in most circumstances, in like an urban zone similar to Atlanta, EMS will be pretty soon behind law enforcement, if not there beforehand. And so if that's a situation and law enforcement got there a minute or two early, they would, you know, first secure the scene, and after securing the scene, administer the medication if they determine it is an overdose. And then once EMS gets there, thanks to the protection of HB 965, which was the Good Samaritan medical amnesty law in Georgia, you know, the individual can be sent to the hospital for medical care if that is what's determined to be the best thing at the time. But that's something we strongly encourage.
But Mona, you know, we're being heard in all kinds of places, even rural areas in Georgia. So let's say you're in a rural area and a police officer administers this drug and saves you from imminent death, but the EMT is 20 to 30 minutes away. What then?
Then it's time for very close monitoring, and it may be time for a backup to get another officer with another dose nearby. Now, that's where problems can happen, because rural officers are already stretched thin, yeah. And to have resources stretched like that is problematic. That's why... as Robert said, we want to have officers as fully prepared as possible. And we're hearing about more and more fentanyl use in the rural areas.
Robert, let me ask you, are you concerned that the price of the drug may deter other law enforcement agencies? I mean, I'm talking about the price of the nasally administered drug. Might deter other police officers from training?
It already has. So it doesn't deter them from getting training on what it would be like. What it does deter them is actually participating in the program. So across North Carolina, across Georgia, and across the United States, you know, this has been a giant problem with the doubling of price because, one, it makes law enforcement departments that want to do the program only get one vial of naloxone, or, you know, they don't, instead of two vials of naloxone, or they don't do it because it's too expensive. So say, for example, you're a mid-sized city or a large city, it's just too expensive. You know, I really, I want to praise Atlanta Police Department for doing it because that is so awesome. And in North Carolina, we've got, you know, departments that have just been like, we're just going to do it and it's worth it to us because we value the lives of our citizens and it's awesome.
Mona, let's take one step back. Can you help me understand why we're seeing such a significant rise in heroin overdose deaths recently?
Well, the heroin use is rising. People got started with opioid painkiller pills. For a long time, there were a lot of opioid painkiller pills around. Now the supply is dwindling, and people are looking around for something else, and that something else is heroin, where an oxycodone pill might cost $40, $80 per pill. One dose of heroin can cost $10, and people are always looking for a good deal, especially if it does what the pill does. And the bag of heroin does what the pill does.
So, Daryl, let me ask you, have you seen this rise in Atlanta as well? Is that what motivated this experiment, I guess, with Narcan in Atlanta?
Yeah, we're seeing an increase in it. Right now, Atlanta Fire Rescue and EMS services are responding to, on average, 2 calls a day related to overdoses using opiates and heroin. So it's a major concern for us in the city and the community, and certainly as public safety officials.
Well, Robert, let me play you this comment here. This is from Ken Ball of the Holly Springs Police Department on why he doesn't want to give needles to his officers.
You know, first responders level is about my limit with training police officers. So that's my objection to it. I don't want them to have to be trained as an EMT to ensure that a needle's injected in the right place and not doing some kind of harm to somebody.
So, Robert, do you have discussions with people like Ken Ball to try to encourage them to use the needles, or does that conversation not happen?
We do encourage people to use the syringe-based one from a cost-benefit analysis. We also may tell them to look into other options, such as getting the auto-injector and working with Kaleo on doing that. But what, you know, in truth, like, syringe-based naloxone is, like, it's the simplest form to use. It's kind of like, you know, people may not like using syringes, but everybody knows how to use one. So there's very little training required, and in fact, over 10,000 people have successfully used naloxone in community-based settings who are not first responders. So, you know, I can train somebody in under 5 minutes how to use syringe-based naloxone successfully. And in North Carolina, from that program, we've had 332 people reverse drug overdoses since we passed our law, you know, a couple of years ago. So
I'm sorry, how many years is that? 332 and how many
That's
years?
Since August 1st, 2013. So, and those are people who've told us. So those people who have, like, fought the stigma and actually called me or came to me in person and said thank you. So we know there's probably way more than that. And we also know if you pass out naloxone, such as Mona's awesome program in Atlanta Harm Reduction, that according to all the medical journal literature, it says, according to British Medical Journal specifically, that if you start a community-based naloxone program, you can reduce overdose mortality by up to 50%.
Right.
Nothing is more successful than getting people naloxone to reduce drug overdose in a community.
That's Robert Childs of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, Mona Bennett of the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition, and Daryl Tollison with the Atlanta Police Department. They spoke in 2015 with GPB Special Correspondent Celeste Headley. And just a note, in that interview, we heard from Ken Ball, who was chief of the Holly Springs Police Department. He has since retired from that post and is now chief deputy of the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Love can take many forms. What if it means becoming more like the person to whom you are married? Tomorrow, we'll hear about research by the University of Georgia that looked at newly married couples and how their personalities changed over the course of the first 18 months. We want to hear from you. How did you change after getting married? Did you become more like the person that you married, or did something entirely different happen? And over what time period did it happen? 18 months? 18 years? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457, and you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, we're at OST Talk. You can be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Archer returned for its ninth season last week on the FX network. The animated series is made in Atlanta, not far from the GPB studios. Actor Lucky Yates is best known for his work on the show as the voice of the mad scientist Dr. Krieger.
What you doing, Krieger?
Well, I feel bad for Archer, so I'm making him some Portuguese flashcards.
Portuguese? But isn't... I thought Krieger was a German name.
Uber German. It means warrior.
How come you know Portuguese?
Because I grew up in Bristol County, Rhode Island.
Beyond his Archer stardom, Lucky Yates is also a member of the Atlanta improv theater group Dad's Garage. But before that, he performed as a puppeteer for Georgia Public Broadcasting's kids show Salsa and at Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke to Yates about the art of puppeteering. They talked in 2015 about the opening of a new Jim Henson collection at the center's Worlds of Puppetry Museum.
Let's talk about how you actually became a puppeteer.
Okay.
Because there's kind of two stories here. There's the story of your epiphany, and then there's the story of your big break, right? Those are two separate things?
Well, yeah, they are. The epiphany just sort of, it was just a wash. It was a clean wash through to the break. I got a job at the Center for Puppetry Arts in the box office.
Selling tickets.
And my first duty, I've studied theater. I've always been an actor. And I've always been way over the top and just nuts, you know, I was constantly being reined in college. Like, you have to act like a normal human being and not a cartoon character.
That's slightly ironic.
And in Chekhov, yeah. You know what
right.
I mean?
I
was a silly old man and I was milking it for everything it could be milked for. So my first job was to go watch the show that they were currently running so that I could sell tickets to it in a knowledgeable way. And it was Space by John Ludwig. And I went and sat and was watching the show, and it was the corny, light from the heavens coming down with angelic voices. And I was like, you can do this for a career? This is exactly what I've been looking for. Puppetry is exactly what I've been looking for. Because I was always a big toy guy, and I had puppets growing up and all that stuff, but I never thought about it as a career choice. And then I started looking at individual performances while I'm watching this first show I've ever seen. You know, and I was like, I think I could probably do it better than that guy that's down there. I think his lip sync is kind of off, and why do I even know what that means? So it was very quick that I got an audition and then was put in a show there, and then I did a show there, and then there were auditions for the show Salsa here at GPB, and then got on that, and then it just, it's all spiraled out of control.
It takes a specific kind of performer, though, to really love having some other face express your emotions.
Yeah, you know what's really funny is you have to pour everything into your forearm and hand. Like, all of your performance and everything, other than your voice, all performance has to be done through your arm, your forearm, while you're holding it above your head for a long periods of time.
Do you do forearm exercises?
I should, but I don't, because I don't know. I maybe dig the pain. Puppetry is pain for anybody looking to get into this career. It never stops hurting, but
there's
maybe because
quote.
I don't do my exercises.
You might want to do some
but
forearm
it is
yoga.
Pain. Now, I think it always hurts no matter what. It's tough to hold your arm above your head for 45 minutes.
Well, I wonder if that puppetry also prepared you to be a voiceover artist, because that's another place in which you're not actually using your own body and face to...
To express everything.
To express emotion.
Although with voice acting, it's great because when you're in the booth, you can actually move around and act. You know what I mean? Whereas with puppetry, you're locked. Your body is usually locked in some sort of impossible, because you're crouched behind and below something, and you're sticking the puppet up where it needs to be, especially if you're doing on-camera stuff and there's a lot of people there, because, you know, your whole world is what is visible on a television screen. And so there's usually like four adult human beings all jammed in the same little spot, and you're fighting for your little place to stand and also get your character up in the air and on camera where it can be seen and act and do all that stuff. It's really, really, it can be intense at times, but there's nothing more fun than puppeteering.
So I'm really glad you're here, because I get to ask all the probably inappropriate questions about puppeteering that I've never been able to ask before.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, lay them on. I am exactly the guy to ask inappropriate questions.
That's what I feel like. I feel like if you're an archer, you're probably open to being asked inappropriate questions. Okay. Yeah. So number one, is there kind of a code among puppeteers about hygiene? I mean, you guys are packed.
You know, I was just having this conversation in the green room. Well, and no, unfortunately, there's not. I bet when people are doing long runs of shows, there will be green room discussions of like, dude, you got to shower. But,
because you are in close quarters.
Yeah. And we had, back when we were doing Salsa, which was the Georgia
Public. That's the Spanish language from GPB. Yeah.
We had one particular puppeteer that was would become extremely gassy after lunch. And he really did not care he didn't care that he was gassy, much
to
the
rest of our... That's an uncomfortable conversation to have with a coworker.
Yeah, and we would yell at him all the time, like, stop it. And he was like, what can I do? They should stop serving me all this lunch. And he was like, well, what are you going to do? Like, you got to eat, man. But just curb it. Like, get Beano. I think somebody started bringing in Beano.
So tell me about the relationship between puppeteering and Atlanta and why it is so close. Jim Henson himself with Kermit cut the ribbon.
Yeah. It's because of the Center for Puppetry Arts. Vince Anthony started, he was a puppeteer and thought, hey, there should be a place where, this art form is really celebrated and worked on and all that kind of stuff. And there was no other place in the country that was doing that kind of thing. As far as having, like, not only theaters, but also a museum and an education department.
Yeah, it feels almost as though the education department is sort of what sets it apart, because there are other cities in which they have healthy puppeteering companies.
Yes.
But there seems to be an emphasis here on really passing down the traditions from generation to generation.
Absolutely correct. I work at Dad's Garage Theater mostly, and we've been doing a puppet
company
show
here
there.
In Atlanta.
Yeah. We've been doing a puppet show there for kids since 2000, and it's kids are already puppet savvy when they get to us because of the center. It has also churned out so many puppeteers, because people come in and they do a few shows and then they move on. And myself and another guy named Bo Brown do these things called puppet slams, which are a collection of short pieces for one night only and stuff like that. And you never hurt for getting people to fill your program for the evening, because the city is full of puppeteers because of the center. People that have worked with them and wanted to have a little voice and do a little 5-minute piece. It's really great.
What does it mean to be puppet savvy?
Just being able to watch some puppetry and get into it and have the sort of your suspension of disbelief immediately goes, like, it expands when a puppet comes out on the stage, I have found. But for kids that like grow up on the art form, as opposed to maybe seeing something on television, but not seeing live theater, the live theater version of it, won't know that a lot of kids get freaked out when they see puppets in real life. But if you grow up going to shows at the center, and they do a really wonderful thing at the end of each performance, they will come out and do a little instructional snippet